So, Mark chapter 14, verses 1 through 25. It was 2 days before the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread. The chief priests and the scribes were looking for a way to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him, for they said, "Not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people." While he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at the table, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment of nard, and she broke open the jar and poured the ointment on his head. But some were there who said to one another in anger, "Why was the ointment wasted in this way? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii, and the money given to the poor." And they scolded her. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has performed a good service for me. For you always have the poor with you, and you can show kindness to them whenever you wish, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for its burial. Truly I tell you, wherever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her." Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. When they heard it, they were greatly pleased and promised to give him money. So they began to look for an opportunity to betray him. On the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb is sacrificed, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and make the preparations for you to eat the Passover?" So he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. And wherever he enters, say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher asks, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' He will show you a large room upstairs, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there." So the disciples set out and went to the city and found everything as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover meal. When it was evening, he came with the 12, and when they had taken their places and were eating, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They began to be distressed and to say to him one after another, "Surely not I." He said to them, "It is the one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the bowl with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that one not to have been born." While they were eating, he took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to them, and said, "Take, this is my body." Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, and all of them drank from it. He said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I tell you, I will never again drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." The word of the Lord. Okay, so in the days immediately preceding the Passover, the desire of the chief priests and the scribes to capture and kill Jesus intensifies, but the timing's kind of odd, because they've had these sort of murderous fantasies before, but they've restrained themselves because Jesus is very popular with the crowds. And so grabbing him at the time of the Passover is the riskiest possible time for them to try to make this move. In fact, Mark quotes them as saying so, "Not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people." Because Jerusalem had a lot of pilgrims come in. I mean, the population expanded exponentially. And so you've got all this intense religious fervor around the greatest holy day of the Jewish religion. You also have a very overcrowded city. So it's a really tense situation. Add to that the fact that most Jews of the first century believed that the Messiah would return during the Passover. I mean, that only makes sense, that the culminating redemptive act of God for his people would occur at the celebration of the time when they were released from their slavery in Egypt, which essentially created them as a people. But despite the fact that they couldn't have picked a worse time, they decided to go after him anyway. And maybe the trigger was the fact that, as we see later on in chapter 14, they had an opportunity in Judas, who was willing to betray him. Or maybe they thought that with the climate so volatile in Jerusalem at that time, it would be easier to get the Roman authorities to crucify him as a way to just sort of sweep him under the rug and not cause trouble. Or maybe they just couldn't stand it anymore. I mean, there's only so much you can take. And maybe they were afraid that no matter what they did, that there could be civil unrest, that Jesus might have revolutionary tendencies which would express itself during the Passover. And that was an issue because the temple leadership collaborated with the Romans. And the Jewish leadership, their job was to prevent civil unrest, to keep order. If they failed in doing that, the Romans held them responsible. So there were threats to their power coming from two directions. One, Jesus was popular, and they were concerned that he would usurp their authority. Secondly, if Jesus created a big enough fuss, the Romans would not be very happy with them. Okay? So, while all this is happening, though, we have to remember that all through Mark, you have two forces at play simultaneously, intertwining with one another. One is the divine will, working to accomplish God's purpose, to accomplish what's necessary for Jesus to be fully revealed as the Messiah. And that can only happen on a cross and a subsequent resurrection. At the same time, human beings do make choices. They weren't puppets on a string any more than we are. These were authentic choices, whether it was Judas's or the chief priests and the scribes or the other disciples who, as we'll see later on in chapter 14, all abandoned Jesus, which is its own type of betrayal. But there was an overlapping that brought Jesus to this specific time and place in a specific way for the fullness of who Jesus was to be revealed as the Davidic Messiah and the Son of God. He needed to die at the Passover. People needed that to make the connection because they expected the Messiah to arrive at the Passover. And so, even though in terms of chronological time, in terms of Chronos, his opposition came after him at the worst possible time. I mean, they could have gotten him earlier. They could have waited a couple of weeks. I mean, why not? They put up with him for this long. But they had to act now so that Jesus could die at the right moment, God's moment, or Kairos. Okay? So it's a blurry kind of gray area here where you have the divine will striving to accomplish this necessary purpose in a particular way, while at the same time you have human beings who are cooperating, usually unconsciously, in doing this, and perhaps being influenced by God along the way. And that's a tension that we all have, okay? You know, we have a relationship with God. To what extent are we truly free in the choices we make? To what extent has sin damaged or perhaps even eliminated our capacity to make a truly free choice? Because our true freedom only comes through God's grace, and to the extent to which we conform to God's will. And so we'll get into that later. But because I don't want to get us off the line of the narrative here. So this is all going on, and verse 3, we made it a long way, haven't we?
Do you need some coffee?
No, I'm fine. I've got bronchitis, and the more I talk, the more I cough, so I'll be fine. So a few days before Passover, Jesus eats with a guy named Simon. We have no idea who he is. Simon was a common name. And he was a leper, and he lived in Bethany, a few miles outside Jerusalem. This was kind of the staging area for Jesus all along. And leprosy covered a wide range of skin ailments, okay? Acne, alopecia, I mean, a lot of stuff. And whether it was considered ritually impure or not, that was up to the priests. They would examine you and determine whether the type and severity of your skin ailment qualified as leprosy as defined in the law of Moses. And if it did, you would be basically cast out of your community because they didn't want the disease to spread and they didn't want people to be ritually defiled. And especially before the Passover, that is not something you would want. Okay? Because basically the way it was structured rabbinically was that if it happened, right near Passover, you had to wait 30 days for kind of a do-over makeup Passover, and then by then the big party was done, and so you're kind of lonely alone, eating your lamb and your unleavened bread in your kitchen. So obviously this guy didn't qualify as a leper, otherwise he wouldn't have been in his home. But it's still symbolic that Jesus would be there with him. Somebody on the margins. It could have gone either way. He could have been sitting there in his dining room, or he could have been on the outskirts of town. While he was there, a woman whose name isn't given. Now, John tells us it's Mary, but Mark doesn't bother. She comes in and basically crashes the party. She has an alabaster jar. She breaks it open. And then she pours this expensive ointment called nard on Jesus' head. And all of this is pretty much borderline scandalous. She's very rude to come into somebody's home uninvited. Unaccompanied women in the evening had certain suspicions about them. Mm-hmm. And there is, if you can imagine the scene in your mind, and the social mores of Jesus' time, for a woman to pour this oil over his head and this perfume is rolling into the room, it was a very intimate and sensual act. And so people would have been disturbed. But it's interesting that what they complain about, and we're not exactly sure who, but I think we have to assume that some of Jesus' disciples were waging the same complaints, is that she had wasted this very precious jar of ointment for no apparent reason other than perhaps as an act of compassion and generosity to Jesus. I mean, it was worth 300 denarii. One denarius was like a daily wage. We're talking about a year's wages. Okay, and they said, this could have been sold and the proceeds could have been given to the poor. And you would think that actually Jesus would have agreed with them. Because so consistently in his ministry in the Gospel of Mark, he's reached out to the poor. In Mark, there's not one miraculous feeding. There are two. The only gospel that has two. All right? So instead, though, he defends her. And he says, basically, in a different situation, you might be right and she might be wrong. But in this situation, it's okay. But because she's preparing me for burial. But one could still argue there is a massive difference in terms of the level of priority of properly preparing a person for burial preemptively and feeding poor people who might die of starvation if you don't help them. And I think that Joel Marcus in his Anchor Bible Commentary puts it well, and this is in your notes, but for the benefit of the people who may be listening online, he wrote, "Granted, however, that both the donation of the money to the poor and the anointing of Jesus are charitable acts, why does the latter take precedence over the former? Jesus answers this implicit question by hinting at his coming death. Assistance to the poor will remain possible in the coming days, but the time for service to the earthly Jesus is rapidly drawing to a close." The first part of Jesus' statement here echoes Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 11, "For the poor will never cease out of the land," a verse that goes on to commend open-handedness to the poor. Jesus is not then devaluing service to the poor, but assuming that it will remain a continuing duty in the coming period. He is also, however, toward a more pressing circumstance in the immediate future, his own approaching death. So, when he says the poor will always be with you, he's not sort of disregarding them. It's just, he's got 2 days in this physical body, and they're going to be poor people until the kingdom comes. And again, it's all about timing. It's all about the symbols predicting his death and the nature of his identity. Because the word Messiah translates from the Hebrew and Aramaic from a word that simply means anointed one. And what we see in the historical books of the Old Testament, like Chronicles and Kings and Samuel, is that kings were identified by being anointed with fragrant oil. It's also worth noting that there's a parallel between this nameless woman and another nameless woman that we've talked about not so long ago. The one who came into the temple and gave her two mites, which were actually these tiny coins, called. Does anybody remember? They're called lepta. I actually asked because I needed a few seconds to retrieve that from my memory. I mean, these coins were... I'm not kidding. That's true. These coins were really...
What were you going to do if that didn't pop back into your mind?
I was going to fiercely shame you all and then hope that at some point it would return to the forefront of my mind.
We wouldn't know the difference anyway.
You would have made it up, you mean?
Exactly.
Cold medicine is great, ain't it? So anyway, this woman, what she gave was essentially worthless. You couldn't have bought anything with it. It's kind of like today's penny. But it was all that she had. And so her sacrifice was so much greater than those who were wealthy and gave a large amount, but it was a very small proportion of their worth. And so he praises that woman, which is odd considering that he is predicting that the temple will be dismantled and that it no longer qualifies as the dwelling place of God. So she's basically giving to a corrupt institution. Why would Jesus affirm that? It's because she's striving to honor God and help achieve God's purposes as she understands them. And so this second woman who anoints him with this very expensive perfume, we don't know how wealthy she was, presumably somewhat, if she could get her hands on that much nard. But she is anointing the new temple where God dwells, manifest, embodied in Jesus. And Jesus said that she'll never be forgotten. That as long as the gospel, as the good news is proclaimed, her act will be remembered, even though, for Mark, her name isn't. And I think that's something instructive to all of us. Most of our names will be forgotten, but our actions, if not consciously remembered, make a contribution to the legacy of the gospel. And it's unfolding, and it's building up to the realization of the temple through God's grace.
Michael, does she appear at any other point in Scripture?
No, although, I mean, this is a story that you'll find in the Gospel of John for sure, and I'm pretty sure that Mark and Luke both have parallels kind of close to Mark. But and John names her as Mary. And a lot of times the, you know, connection is made between this Mary and Mary Magdalene. And there's a lot of kind of speculation and inference about the identity of this woman and her motives and how that adds meaning to the event. And in one instance, it's not actually this ointment that she puts on his head, but she actually stoops to his feet and cries on his feet and then wipes his feet with her hair, which is a tremendous symbol of humility. And of course, she's criticized for this very, very intimate, kind of embarrassing act. And Jesus said, you know, hey, you didn't even show me basic hospitality when I came into your home. I mean, the norm is that you at least wash my feet because I've been walking out on these dusty, manured field roads all day. And you skip that part. And so she came in and did your job for you. Leave her alone. He could smack you around pretty good. And still can. We have to be mindful of that. He don't play around because he's God. Judas clears off and basically offers the chief priests an opportunity to seize Jesus. And it's such a stark contrast to this woman and her parallel, the woman in the temple giving her two lepta. And they're trying to build up God's house, and he's trying to tear down the one that really matters, although ultimately he and his collaborators will fail. Now, they do give him money, or promise to give him money, but unlike other Gospels where his motive is ascribed as greed, that's not explicitly mentioned here. Now, you might infer it from the complaints of the waste of resources from the woman who poured the ointment over Jesus' head, coupled with the fact that they're going to give him money. But here, there's no identification as Judas, as sort of the treasurer of Jesus' disciples, the one who kept the common purse and stole from it. We do not know why he did this. Now, there's a lot of speculation about why maybe he did. Maybe he felt like Jesus wasn't kind of living into the type of Messiah he was supposed to be, because he wasn't the Messiah that most people expected. We've talked about this a lot. I'm not going to cover that ground again. But if Jesus were forced into a position where he had to become more militant, you know, that's a potential motivation of Jesus. So that sees Judas as a potentially faithful disciple of Jesus who's trying to shift events in such a way that Jesus can finally take the plunge and become the Messiah that everybody expected so that he could be more successful. It's also potentially that Judas got cold feet. You know, he could perceive the way things were going. Jesus had not been coy about predicting his death to his disciples, and he wanted to be on a different side. But we just don't know. This is the first time Judas has been mentioned since chapter 3, verse 19. So basically we have no information on the guy. And after we have this little interlude, the disciples want to know, hey, where do you want to eat for Passover, Jesus? And it's the first day of unleavened bread. The Feast of Unleavened Bread was a week-long festival. And that and Passover used to be separate, but over time they became joined together, which only makes sense. Because the Passover feast, and you can read about it in Exodus 14 and 15, the Passover feast, they had to do three things. 9 plagues had come through. Number 10's coming that very night, and it's going to be an angel of death who is going to kill the firstborn of every household of Egypt, including the animals. And apparently, the angel of death couldn't distinguish Egyptians from Hebrews. So what you had to do is you had to sacrifice a lamb without blemish, take some of its blood, and put it on the doorpost of your house. Okay, it's kind of like turning your light on at night if you were actually giving out candy on Halloween. And that way the angel of death would pass over them. Okay, and that's where you get the Feast of the Passover. And then they had to roast the lamb. They had to eat it all. And they also had to prepare this unleavened sort of flatbread. You've all had matzah, I'm sure. And the reason was is that the urgency around the situation was so great. They didn't have time to let the dough rise and bake it. Okay, so this was kind of a very raw, simple meal associated with poverty. And they had to do it with their loins girded, because in the morning when people woke up to see their firstborn all dead, Pharaoh's going to freak out and say, fine, go. I'm good. Just get out. Okay. And so it's sensible that these two festivals, originally separate in Torah, would be meshed together, and because they celebrate the same event, liberation from captivity in Egypt. And Jesus, in answer to their question, gives them instructions that are almost identical to what he gives them in chapter 11 when he sends them in the town to get a donkey or colt, depending on your translation, so that he could ride triumphantly into Jerusalem. He basically says, you two go into town and you're going to find a guy carrying a jar of water. Follow him. He's going to lead you to a house, and you're going to tell the master of the house, the teacher wants to know, where's my room? And he's going to show it to you, and then I want you to finish up getting ready. Now, maybe Jesus had worked with some covert disciples he had in Jerusalem to set all this up. Although it does beg the question, you know, it's likely a lot of people were carrying jars of water. How could they possibly have known which one to follow? So that's the possibility. But the other possibility is throughout Mark's Gospel, Jesus' capacity to supernaturally penetrate people's thoughts, to know what they're thinking and to respond to it. This could simply be another episode of this. Again, as Marcus writes, it is not accidental that these premier demonstrations of clairvoyance appear precisely in relation to the events of Holy Week. It was those events that most seriously called Jesus' sovereignty into question. If he was God's all-knowing Messiah, how did he end up nailed to a Roman cross? Mark's answer is that a divine necessity stood behind this apparent outrage. The plot of Judas and the Jewish leaders against Jesus succeeded only because God had planned things that way from the beginning. So this sort of setup that gets them to the upper room is all part of a broader plan, and that it's Jesus' supernatural insight that enables him to direct his disciples and maybe even to a certain extent endow them with the same power so they could pick out the right guy carrying the jug of water. Okay. Now, some scholars will say it was not normal for men to carry jugs of water. That was women's work back then. And you can argue about that. So you could say, well, if there was a man carrying a jug of water, that would have been unusual, so they'd have been able to pick him out, lickety-split. But remember, the estimates of the number of people in Jerusalem at this point in time is anywhere from maybe 250,000 to 500,000, depending on who you're talking about. So the idea that they're just going to bump into one guy carrying a jar of water doesn't hold any water with me. Pardon the pun. Anyway, however it all came about, the disciples find who they're looking for, and they get ready for the meal, which would have included sacrificing a lamb at the temple for them to eat that night. Now, you don't see that in the Last Supper, but it's assumed. I mean, this is happening on the eve of Passover. You're going to eat the lamb. And you didn't have to be in Jerusalem to do this. Not everybody can make the pilgrimage. Jerusalem would have never held them all. They wouldn't have had enough time to sacrifice them all in the temple. It would have been overwhelming. So you could do this at home. That was kosher. But if your lamb was sacrificed in the temple at Jerusalem, you had to eat it inside the city walls. So at this sacred meal, Jesus announces, somebody's going to betray me. And as you can imagine, they're pretty upset. And in attempts to subtly exonerate themselves, they say, surely not I. I mean, that's not a question, it's a statement of vindication. And he says, well, it's the one dipping their bread in the same bowl with me. And think about you're at a party and there are like several different bowls of salsa and you're sort of sharing a bowl with somebody. Okay, so they'd have like sauces and stuff that they would dip their bread in and things like that. And so you'd think that might have clued them into who it was, but it's possible that more than one person was dipping their bread into Jesus' dish, in which case you would think the natural reaction would be to take whoever that was and interrogate them fiercely until they squeezed out who was going to do it. Mark, unlike some other Gospels, don't explicitly identify Judas, because for him it would be redundant. Because he's already identified Jesus as the betrayer way back in chapter 3. You would think the disciples would have taken action if they'd known. And maybe this is one of those times when they're being stupid disciples. Where they just don't really quite get it. And I can understand that. I mean, I'm like, some of the times when they didn't understand these fairly straightforward parables and stuff like that, I mean, they had to have been in shock. You know, it would have been scarcely believable. I mean, it would be like me on a Sunday in the pulpit saying, one of you is going to get me killed. You know, and here's a clue as to who it's going to be. It would be very difficult for you to believe that. That someone in that room would want to kill me. So I think that's maybe where they were. We have to be careful about trying to psychologize the disciples, but they were human like us, so we can draw some correlations. And just as Jesus praised this woman at the dinner party who anointed his head, he condemns his betrayer. It would have been better for this person to have never been born. And that takes us right back to Mark chapter 9, verse 42. Where he says the same about those who lead astray people who want to be faithful to Jesus. It'd be better if a millstone was wrapped around your neck and you were thrown into the depths of the sea and that you'd never been born. And again, we see the overlay between the necessity of what's happening and God's intention behind it and human choices. Jesus says, "For as the Son of Man goes, as it is written of him." Okay, so what's about to happen is actually the fulfillment of a necessary prophecy. But Judas, obviously, when you look at Jesus' condemnation, is morally responsible. So you could say that God's working through Judas to, you know, work out his actions. And in fact, in the apocryphal Gospel of Judas, which was just discovered like 6 or 7 years ago, it was in the news a lot. It's basically a gospel, probably 2nd century, they found it in Egypt, trying to justify what Judas did. And it, basically, it's along the lines of Jesus taking Judas aside and saying, okay, for this to work, these chief priests and scribes are so stupid that they're going to need some help. They're going to need an inside man on this job. And I know it's going to be tough, Judas, because you love me more than any of the others. But you have to be the guy. So you're going to go to them. You're going to tell them where I'm going to be at a specific time. It's going to be a secluded place. That way they can nab me without a whole lot of fuss. Okay? It's basically what the Gospel of Judas is about. That's why it's not in the Bible. And again, Judas might have seen himself as trying to fulfill God's purposes, but he didn't understand them properly, and so he's actually working against God's purposes. And any time you're doing that, you're sinning. Any time you work against God's true purposes, you're working for evil. And so Judas has moral responsibility, while at the same time, he is operating within the realm of executing God's intention. Here's what blows my mind. Jesus says, one of you is going to get me killed, and they keep eating. You know, you would have think that would have just broken the party up right there. But, you know, many lesser things have stopped the party dead in its tracks. But they keep on going, and Jesus initiates what we would now call the Last Supper, or Communion, or Eucharist. And it's a transformation of the Passover meal. And so he becomes the Lamb whose sacrifice signifies God's liberating grace. Except unlike the original Passover in Egypt at the Exodus, where people are liberated from political and socioeconomic oppression, in this case, people are liberated from sin and death itself. It's the ultimate Passover, where death passes you over through the blood of Jesus if you embrace him, if you share in him, in part through this sacred meal. And the bread which Jesus blesses, breaks, and gives, which are key verbs that we always repeat in Eucharist at the Great Thanksgiving. In the Passover event, the breaking, who got broken in the Passover? Pharaoh did. Okay? And the blessing is God's gift of freedom. Now, it's Jesus' blessing on all people, because he will be broken on the cross. Not literally, because that would violate one of the prophecies. His bones weren't broken, but his body certainly was. And his identification of this bread as his body has generated controversy over exactly what does he mean by that straight up to this day. Okay? And I think we're probably at least familiar in passing, like in the Roman Catholic Church, thank you Thomas Aquinas, they believe in something called transubstantiation. And Aquinas was a brilliant 13th century theologian who just happened to be living in a period when trade with the Middle East got to a point where lost Greek texts were coming over. So a lot of Aristotle that had been lost in what we call the Dark Ages started flowing into Western Europe. And he had to synthesize this revered philosopher with extant Christian theology. Okay? He was basically trying to hijack Aristotle so Aristotle wouldn't present a threat to Christian theology. Aristotle distinguished between the substance and the accidents of something. Okay? The substance was what something really was. The accidents was what something appeared to be. Okay? So in transubstantiation, and I know that we're backing off the narrative here a little bit, but we're almost finished with this section anyway. In communion, the invocation of the words Jesus used, along with the invocation of the Holy Spirit, transforms the substance of the bread into human flesh. But it does not change the accidence, its appearance. So it doesn't look or taste or smell like human flesh. It tastes and looks and smells like bread. But that's just the accidence. The actual substance is the body of Jesus. This is a literalistic interpretation and application of what Jesus said at the Last Supper with his disciples. We are consubstantiationists. And what that means is, con means just with. So context means with the text. So we believe that Jesus is with the substance, but the substance isn't fundamentally altered. So the bread is bread, but Jesus is spiritually present in the bread. Jen? Accidents, yeah. Like boom, crash, call your insurer. Yeah, except different. Yeah. And then, of course, on the more Protestant end of the scale, they interpret it ironically in a much looser sense, that this is just something that, you know, we remember. And so, for like your average Presbyterian, this is something you do to remember a key event in the life of our faith that preceded the key event of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. For us, it's more than remembering. Because the word, you know, at the very end we say, do this in remembrance of me. Okay? The word remembrance is anamnesis. You get like a bonus, you know, sacramental lecture today. And the word anamnesis means a lot more than remember. It means to participate in and be present to. All right? So for us, we're actually participating in this past event in the present time.
In the same way that the Jews participate in Passover.
Right. When the Jews tell the story of Passover that night, they don't say, our ancestors did such and such and such and such and such and such. They say, we were led through the Red Sea on dry land. Okay? And they mean it. They mean it. And so should we. Because in the midst of the blessing of the bread and the wine, when we say or sing together the Sanctus, the Holy, Holy, Holy Lord God of Hosts, we say, joining our voices with angels and archangels, and with all the company of heaven. So during worship, chronos, chronological time, out the window. All right? This is why I get really annoyed if people complain that I'm out 5 minutes late. Because this is a kairos moment. This is a God moment. It's your wristwatch is irrelevant during this period of time because we're being conjoined with the eternal worship of heaven. In a way that we can't fully understand. It's a sacred mystery. So anyway, so you could have taken what Jesus said about the bread being his body any one of a number of different ways. It's a fascinating debate, and we can engage in it in greater depth later if you like. And then he does the same thing with the cup of wine, identifying it with his blood, using the same basic process. He can't break wine, but he gives thanks, blesses it, gives thanks for it, which is basically the same thing as a blessing, shares it with them. And the image of cup in the Old Testament generally symbolizes wrath and punishment. You can take a look at Isaiah chapter 51, verses 17 through 23, and Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 15. But it can also be viewed positively as well. In Psalm 116, verse 3, refers to the cup of salvation. In this case, the cup symbolizes both. Jesus is going to suffer. And not long from now, he's going to be in the Garden of Gethsemane saying to God, you know, if this cup doesn't necessarily have to be drunk by me, that I'd be okay with that, if that's a live option. But, you know, your will be done. But this cup, so bitter and deadly to him, is the one, the shedding of his blood that grants salvation to many. Then at the very end of what we're working with today, he says, This is my last drink. I'm going on the wagon after this. And basically what he's talking about is that he's inaugurating the kingdom through this feast. I mean, in himself. And so in transforming the Passover meal, which is intended to be persistently repeated as a feature of Christian worship, and in all of the earliest Christian records that we have, including biblical and non-biblical sources, this was like the main deal. This wasn't something you did once a month or once a quarter or at Easter and Christmas. This is something you did every time you got together. Read Paul, 1 Corinthians. Okay, they weren't worshiping right. He straightens them out in a hurry. And he basically gives an identical witness to the gospel writers. And so they're all working off of the same oral and written fragmentary text. It's even possible the gospel writers are working off of Paul at this point. But when he comes back in glory, when he returns, as he's described in chapter 13 of Mark, then he will drink the wine new, because the creation will be renewed and restored to God's intentional, to God's original intention for creation. And this will be the time when the eschaton, the fulfillment inaugurated by Jesus in his life, ministry, death, and resurrection, will be finally realized and fulfilled. Okay? So that's the first 25 verses of chapter 14. Yeah, it's really dense, rich material. Which is why we're busting up these chapters into much smaller segments than we've had in the past. So questions, things you want to explore further, things you're seeing I'm not seeing.
I find the difference between John saying that they're actually in the house and Lazarus is there with Martha, who's doing the cooking,
yep,
and Mary, and this unknown woman who pours it over his head compared to what Martha does to his feet. What's the difference between the two?
There is. I mean, the connection with the ointment to Messiah is much more direct. I mean, you know, there's potentially some connection between, you know, because John actually doesn't have a clear account of the Last Supper. More like a vague allusion. In chapter 13, what he substitutes for that essentially is the washing of the feet. So there may be a connection between those two in the tradition. Not that Jesus' feet needed to be washed, but you know, it's just a sign of intense humility. And there were variations. I mean, I passed a car wreck on my way into work today. And, you know, I don't know if anybody saw it, but if it was more than one person, you're going to get more than one story. And if you ask the same people, you know, 2 weeks from now, you're going to get different stories from them 2 weeks from now than you got from them today. A human memory is a very elastic thing. And human perception is intensely conditioned by our prior experiences. We see what we've trained ourselves to see. And so John and Mark and Matthew and Luke, along with Paul, they were all choosing, you know, like any good chronicler would. I mean, you can't include everything. And they weren't trying to write a history or a biography or anything like that. The concept of that, it wasn't, as we understand it in the modern world, really wasn't quite there. I mean, a Herodotus or a Josephus is not like a Max Boot, you know, or a Robert Caro, you know, meticulously sourcing their information and lots of footnotes and all this. That's because they were on about something else. They wanted to convince people Jesus was the Messiah, and that's all they cared about. And so there are going to be all these stories floating around about his life and ministry. I mean, if you took what we have in Mark about what Jesus did, you could probably compress it into about a 3-week time frame. Okay? Even though the general estimate of the length of his ministry based on all four Gospels is anywhere from 1 to 3 years. So they're picking and choosing here. Yep. You know, Mark's obsessed about exorcisms. The other Gospel writers, not so much. Why? Because Jesus exercising demons reveals something about who he is as Son of God in terms of his power over evil. Okay? Matthew, Luke, and John see him in different ways. And these complementary ways of seeing Jesus provide us with a fuller picture. Okay? So, it's entirely possible that both events happened. That a woman came in and anointed Jesus' head with expensive nard, and that another woman, or maybe even the same woman, came in to a different dinner party, cried over his feet, and wiped them off with her hair. But one gospel writer chooses one, another, because of what it says about who Jesus is. And how compelling is it? How well does it fit in with these other choices I've made about what to include as I try to construct this portrait of how God's revealing himself through Jesus as the Christ? Yeah, Bob.
To a fault, I am sort of practical. I see something or hear something. I immediately have some kind of a reaction. Here we're talking about, they're having this Last Supper, and he talks about Judas, or somebody's going to betray me, and they just keep eating, and like it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Okay. And here earlier we're talking about he is talking about his coming death, that I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Yet when this is expressed, we don't see any reaction. Or, I mean, if that were me, I'd be going ballistic. I'd be going, well, wait a minute, what do you mean you're going to die? You can't do that.
Yeah.
How can we stop this?
He wouldn't say pass the celery, you know. that's nice. You know, salt, please. Some people would say, well, you know, Jesus had repeatedly predicted his death. He'd done it 3 times in the back half of the gospel. And so by now they should have figured out that this was going to happen. Although, you know, initially they really didn't understand it, because the first prediction was when Peter identified Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God, Jesus said, okay, glad you've got that part. Here's the other part. I'm going to die and I'm going to be killed. And Peter gets upset and he says, no, that's not how it's going to work out. If I have anything to do with it. And then Jesus condemns Peter very harshly for that. So, It is an incredible thing. I mean, it really is. And maybe at this point, you know, this is prediction number 4 by my count. Maybe there's like, yeah, Jesus says that all the time, and here he is, living and breathing, healthy as a horse, you know. Go figure.
There's also the possibility that their ears were stopped.
Yeah. I mean, the disciples loved Jesus enough that if they saw a threat to his person, one would think that they would have taken direct intervention to try to stop it. And, you know, in verse 47 of chapter 14, when they come to arrest him, but one of those who stood drew near, drew his sword, and struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. So when it becomes obvious to them that he's about to be arrested and, you know, and potentially killed, they resort to violence. And so it could be that their stupidity throughout has in part been caused by God. I mean, hard-heartedness, both in Mark's gospel, chiefly in relation to the religious elite, hearkening back to Exodus, where Pharaoh's heart was hardened. It's a two-way street. I mean, we talked about this a lot when we did Exodus about a year ago, is that Pharaoh's heart was hard because he was a cruel, tyrannical, extremely arrogant person. But God also hardened his heart. Why? Because it served God's purpose for Pharaoh's heart to remain hard until a certain sequence of events could occur that would glorify God among the Egyptian people. So it's a both and situation. His heart is hard because of the choices he makes and what he thinks, but at the same time God puts him in that position, and it's very difficult to disentangle. It's very difficult to understand how we can truly act freely while at the same time being caught up in I mean, it goes back to Romans too, which is the book we studied before we got into Mark. And I know this was like 4 or 5 months ago, but you know what Paul says is, all of this awful sin and the law of the Torah, which ostensibly was to keep people from sinning, but actually caused them to become more aware of their sin, which only accentuated the degree of offense before God because they should have known better now that they've got the law. All of this is part of God's purpose because it's kind of like a drunk. Until you hit rock bottom, you're not going to be able to climb your way back to the top. And so until the problem of sin and evil gets to be so bad in the world, so bad that only the Son of God can sort it out and fix it, it's only at that point that people, both Jew and Gentile, will be empowered to recognize Jesus as the Messiah. And even then, most of them won't. You know, so in a way, the Torah is used as a tool by God to make things worse, at least in Paul's perspective, so that the one true faithful Israelite, incarnate as Jesus, can fulfill the covenant and then release the promise of salvation and sanctification to all people. Judy, you've been very patient.
Well, yeah.
As I've rambled on. Yeah.
I see the Old Testament as the Jews allocating God as the source of all action, the source of all life, the source of everything. Whereas I think it comes down to God using the decisions of humankind to further His purpose. Not that He's causing humankind to have a hard heart, but He's using that hard heart.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a god-awful mess. It's a chicken or egg thing, and I hear exactly what you're saying. I mean, basically, when it comes to God's omniscience, He knows everything.
Right.
Okay. And the way I think about it, well, two images I'll try to present to you, and maybe one of them, if I'm lucky, will make sense. You know those books they have for kids where you get to decide how the story goes? You know, and it says, so if so-and-so does this, turn to page 44. If so-and-so does this, turn to page 83. And then you read a little more, and you have another fork in the road. Or you can think of it as a chess master. You know, somebody like Garry Kasparov, he can see, like, every potential move that you and he might be able to make, depending on the moves that you do make, like 6 or 7 moves down the line. Okay? So, for me, with God being omniscient, He sees every potential choice we'll ever make. And He sees the new options that will be opened because of that choice and the options that will be foreclosed because of that choice. So He sees every possibility of every human choice forever. And He can see it all at once. Okay? So essentially, God has a pretty clear idea of what's going to happen. And maybe He already knows exactly what choices we're going to make. That doesn't necessarily mean that God's knowledge of those choices conditions us in a severely predestined sort of way, which is how some people do understand that you came to Bible study this morning because God, from the beginning of time, foreordained that you would come to Bible study this morning. Okay? Which just is a concept I can't quite fit into my head. So I agree with you, Judy. It's, you know, if it hadn't been Judas, God would have, it would have happened a different way. Yeah. Because He is the prime mover, to borrow a term from the deists. He's the prime mover who sets all this into motion, the entire creation. And so He's written the rules. He's generated the conditions. We're limited in time and space. We're only so smart. You know, we have these remarkable yet frail human bodies. And we have the capacity to make choices that enable us to sin. And sin has consequences. I mean, that's perhaps one of the thorniest theological issues, is that God created a universe where sin was possible. Which leads to the question, to what extent is God then responsible for sin? You know, it's kind of like the people who set the rules for football. Until there was a rule against popping a quarterback in the head and really ringing his bell were the people who set the rules in some way responsible for people who have traumatic brain injury as a result. Well, the courts of the United States say, yeah. Which is why the NFL is paying out a ton of money to take care of these people who were injured. Now the rules have changed. But my theology professor, who taught a course on evil, and was also a holder of a doctorate of jurisprudence, he said, God is not responsible for sin and evil. However, as the creator of all things, he is implicated. I just love that. Only Walter. Only a guy with the PhD in theology from Harvard and the JD from Columbia could ever come up with something like that. It's the only place in all my reading and having been taught that I've run into the concept. I love it. And Paul seems to actually validate that in Romans.
Do we assume from this one that Judas is there and receives the bread and the wine?
Yeah. In other accounts of the Passion, he leaves. I think it's in John. I'm sorry, I didn't really have time to do all the comparative work that I hoped to. But I'm also trying to keep us in Mark. You know, because when you get into the comparatives, it's really easy to get them blended in your brain. Kind of like we do with the birth narratives. I mean, okay, so were the Magi in Luke or Matthew? And where were the shepherds and the angels? And was it Bethlehem or Nazareth? And when did they run off to Egypt because of the slaughter of the kids in Bethlehem? Let me just flip here real quick. Why am I looking in John? Because he actually doesn't have a Eucharist in his... a proper Last Supper in his Gospel. In one of them, which I'm going to find momentarily, Judas up and leaves in the middle of the meal.
Jesus tells
him to. Yeah, and you know it's kind of funny because the assumption of the disciples is, oh, he's going to the grocery. They're like, oh, there's something we need that we don't have, and he's keeper of the common purse, and so he's going out to buy something. I mean, it's just like dense. But you know. They were the originals, and so we have to be cautious about presuming that we're smarter than they are. In fact, part of the whole purpose of Mark's gospel, you know, the secrecy of the gospel, the stupid disciples, and the fact that in the very first verse he says, "This is a story about Jesus. He's the Son of God." The message to this community is, you don't have any excuses because you're post-resurrection people, and you should know better. Okay? You should know better. And so as ridiculous as it seems that these disciples wouldn't get it, you really ought to know better. I'm in 22. And of Luke, sorry. And it's got to be in Matthew because it's not in Luke. That's your homework. Go ahead. Go home. Look. Come back with answers. What else we got going on here? While you're thinking about what you'd like to talk about next, I'll take a real peep real quick. Beverly, that's an excellent question, and the short answer is we don't know. In the commentary I'm relying on most heavily, which is this Joel Marcus 2-volume commentary, he has appendices at the end to sort of deal with some of the thornier things. Okay, so he's got an appendices about Messiah. What's that all about? or the opponents of Jesus? Who were the chief priests? Who were the scribes? Who were the Pharisees? Why would they have such a big problem with him? He has an appendix about crucifixion. He has an appendix about the fact that we're not really sure where the Gospel of Mark ends. Does it end with the 8th verse of chapter 16, the 12th verse, or the 20th verse? Or are those amendments something that people made up so the Gospel could be better rounded with resurrection appearances? And there is an appendix that tries to explain what this whole guy running off naked is all about in verse 51 and 52. And haven't read the appendix yet because I don't have to until I get the notes ready for next week. And honestly can't remember. I mean, I've studied Mark before, obviously. And I've had the opportunity to preach on this Passion narrative because every 3 years it comes up as the Passion narrative we use on Palm Sunday. And in fact, this is year A, and so this is the Passion narrative we get. So more about that next week. But there's an enormous amount of speculation about who he was and all this, and what does the nakedness symbolize? I mean, is it simply the sheer terror that he felt at the events unfolding around him as a way of accentuating the cowardliness and the faithlessness of the disciples abandoning Jesus when the heat came? Or is there more to it than that? And that's something that David will lead you through next week. And we can certainly revisit the week after. No pressure, Dave. No pressure. Yeah.
Judas leaving, I don't know if this is what we're looking for, was John 13.
Thank you. He leaves at the washing of the feet. Yeah.
He's dipping the bread, and as soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered. Let's see. Yeah, as soon as he had taken the bread, he went out, and it was none. That's verse 30.
Yeah, if you look in 13, you have the washing.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus' prediction that somebody's going to betray him. And then, I love this, Simon Peter motions to the one that Jesus loved, who we're not sure who it is, we think it might be John himself, and he says, find out who he's talking about. And so he asks, who is it? And he's like, I'm going to give this guy a piece of bread, and whoever dips it in the dish with me, that's your man. And he dips it in and gives it to Judas, and then he leaves, and the disciples do nothing. Some thought that because Judas had the common purse, Jesus was telling him, but what need Bible we need to have for the festival, or that he should give something to the poor. So they just let him go. But this meal is not a Passover meal because John's timing is different.
Yes.
John versus the Synoptic Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke have the events of his death occurring on the day before the Passover for a lot of reasons we can get into in subsequent weeks if you like. And that's, you know, for some people a real problem. You have to find some way to harmonize that, otherwise the conflict invalidates the truth of the gospel. And for me, this feeling, this thought that since there's this slight disagreement in the timing of when these events occurred, and usually comes from the impulse that the Bible can only be interpreted literally, that, you know, this is the thread that if you pull it hard enough, the whole tapestry is going to come apart. There's a huge difference between facts and truth. Okay? Facts can create truth. Okay? They're constituent elements of truth. But a fact is not the same thing as the truth. They're two realities of a different order of magnitude from one another. Okay? So the fact of the crucifixion and resurrection is essential to the truth of Jesus as Messiah and Son of God. Okay, but the fact of when it happened is, as the Protestants and the Reformation would have said, adiaphora. In other words, it doesn't make any difference. When they were distinguishing themselves from the Roman Catholic Church and its worst abuses, and they kept going on and on and on and on, they got to the point where they said, if it doesn't really matter, if it's inessential, it's got to go. Adiaphora. And so to me, the difference between John the Synoptics, it's adiaphora. I don't care when it happened. I believe that it did, and I believe in the meaning that the gospel tells us about what the event was. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I was thinking of the different timing of the cleansing. John's the one that has the cleansing of the temple so early.
Super early, yeah.
Right away, and then different in the Synoptics.
Yeah.
There's two things there. Some of it depends on the point the author is trying to make. The other is memory. I mean, several of us here have traveled to the same places together. We've done the same things together, but our memories, as for the timing of what happened in these places and times, are different.
Yeah, and I see Mark and John operating probably 20 to 30 years apart, and they're hearing the same story, or they're reading like the same little account of this cleansing of the temple, but nobody's quite sure when it happened. You know, was it immediately before Jesus was crucified? Was this kind of like the last straw for the chief priests and the scribes? Or was this something that happened early on in Jesus' ministry, as it does in John, to set the tone for everything that follows it? And if John and Mark weren't sure when it happened, then, hey, it's fair game. You can stick it in there wherever you think it fits the best to make your case. We are out of time, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. And let's say a quick prayer, and we're off. God, we give you thanks that through Jesus and his sacrifice, you have provided us with forgiveness of sin, means of reconciliation, and the opportunity to participate in the preparation for his coming again in glory. We ask that you keep within us and among us a deep sense of urgency, that we would remain faithful, that we would spread the good news, and that we would bring Jesus into us through the bread and the wine of Holy Communion, that he and we might be one. And all this we ask in the name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.